Good morning. This is Weekend Ozarks at Large for March 23rd, 2014. I'm Christina Thomas.
And I'm Antoinette Grajeda. The choir of men and boys of St. Thomas Church, 5th Avenue, New York City, will sing Evensong and a concert of classic anthems on Wednesday, March 26th at 7 o'clock at St. Paul's Episcopal Church in Fayetteville. Located at East Avenue at Dixon Street, this event is free and all are welcome. stpaulsfay.org for more information.
Ahead on this edition of Weekend Ozarks, the sacrifices some professors make when they sign on as an adjunct. Plus, the personal papers of the prominent Arkansas politician, Dale Bumpers, are opened at the University of Arkansas.
But first, with the Arkansas legislature's fiscal session coming to a close, in addition to many happenings around the region, the week was rife with news. Ozarks at Large's Timothy Dennis has more in this week's Week in Review.
Governor Mike Beebe this week issued a line item veto on a budget bill provision aimed at exempting sales tax collections on sand used in oil and natural gas drilling. In a letter to lawmakers, the governor said the legislator made a substantive change to state law without following the proper constitutional steps during a fiscal session. Matt DeCampbell is the governor's spokesman.
When the voters of Arkansas created the fiscal sessions in the Constitution, they specifically had a clause in there saying that to consider something like this, which is tax policy and not just appropriating money for the budget, you needed a two-thirds majority of both houses to approve it before it went. It would be considered. Doing it through special language, we don't think, complies with the constitutional requirement.
But legislators voted Wednesday to override the governor's veto. The sales tax exemption was inserted in a bill by a special language subcommittee. Republican Stephen Meeks represents some of the areas that are home to natural gas drilling operations, and he said the veto override will benefit the industry.
I think that whenever we have the opportunity to provide clarity on an issue, it is our responsibility to provide that clarity, and that's what this special language is designed to do.
Meeks said that making drilling sand tax exempt helps to better define an earlier tax break for equipment used in manufacturing, but that view wasn't universal among legislators. Speaking after the vote, Democratic Minority Leader Greg Gledding said he disagrees with Meeks.
I think it was probably overstepping the parameters of the fiscal session. I don't necessarily have a problem with the exemption, but I do have an issue with the way that we went about it this fiscal session, and so that's why I did vote to sustain the governor's veto.
Overriding the veto only required a simple majority. The House of Representatives voted 55-41 to override the veto, while the Senate voted 26-7. In other news, the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics released new state unemployment numbers this week, and figures released by the Arkansas Department of Workforce Services show an increase in the number of workers who've found a job. The unemployment rate dropped 0.1% to 7.3% in January. Dr. Michael Paco with the UALR Institute for Economics Advancement says the numbers show overall positive trends in the state's economy.
What we're seeing is that some weakness that had seemed to pervade labor markets through much of 2012 and 2013 seems to have really turned around. Since about August of last year, we're seeing the trends all move in a positive direction, so I think that's very encouraging.
Paco notes that the service sector seems to be doing the most hiring. He also says that sectors like construction are relatively stable, even though a downturn in construction jobs is typical through the winter months. Also this week, Academy Award-winning actor Jeff Bridges ate breakfast with students at Stevens Elementary School in Little Rock. The appearance was aimed at advocating for school breakfast programs. The star of The Big Lebowski and True Grit fame said small changes, such as moving breakfast from before to after the bell, help ensure children will be at school when meals are served.
The government has made, you know, over $1 billion available to states, but it's also so important for governors champion this breakfast after the bell, so they can take advantage of that, of those funds. If not, you know, they're losing money that could go to, you know, bettering their condition of the kids in their state.
Bridges was speaking as part of the No Kid Hungry campaign, which seeks to coordinate private, nonprofit, and governmental programs designed to help feed low-income children. Arkansas ranks second in the nation in food insecurity, but the state is also one of the top 10 states increasing breakfast participation for school children. The University of Arkansas System Board of Trustees Thursday gave its approval for the creation of a new online-only university called eVersity. UA System President Dr. Donald Bobbitt argues that online education won't cannibalize student enrollment at existing brick-and-mortar universities.
My expectation and our experience not only of us but of others in other states is that these completely online students who tried college and perhaps weren't successful for a variety of reasons, they are not going to come to a traditional campus. And so our initial assumption is, and I think it's based upon some sound evidence, is that these will be net new students that we will attract.
But Bobbitt does acknowledge there will be some overlap in online courses already offered by existing UA campuses. He also says that funding for the online university won't affect appropriations for the U of A system's physical campuses scattered across the state.
We were very frank with the trustees. We have no intention of submitting the student semester credit hours that we generate at the eVersity to the state for formula funding. That means it's the amount of money the state is spending on higher ed right now and is distributed to each of the campuses, not just those at the U of A system, but across the state. We really don't have an interest in that. If we can't make it go with tuition dollars that we're going to charge, then we're not going to be able to offer that program, or we'll have to close the doors.
Bobbitt says the program may also pursue unconventional semesters, perhaps offering as many as 8 different 6-week semesters a year. The proposal passed without dissent, and classes are expected to begin in the fall of 2015. From the Harold and Blanche Kalk News Studio, I'm Timothy Dennis, and this is Weekend Ozarks at Large.
This is Weekend Ozarks at Large. American public colleges and universities are increasingly containing wage and benefit costs by hiring contingent faculty, those without permanent status, or who teach part-time. As Ozarks at Large's Jacqueline Froelich reports, while certain contingent faculty are satisfied with their contracts, many say they face an ivory ceiling.
Mary Smith teaches part-time at Northwest Arkansas Community College in Bentonville.
All right, this is my W-2 form for the year 2013, and it shows me making a grand total of $16,800 before taxes and other withdrawals, and that's making the maximum amount that I can make in a year.
Smith, not her real name because she wants to keep her adjunct job, says she's paid per credit hour, 3 hours per week per semester, times 3 because she teaches 3 different classes. But Smith says, unlike full-time faculty, she's not paid for extraneous work.
There's grading, there's lesson planning, fine-tuning. There's always the students who have questions that you have to meet with them, it varies a lot.
And each semester's a new teaching contract.
Because we're treated as though we are new employees when we start the new semester. So we have to wait 2 pay periods before we get our first paycheck. But yet the state of Arkansas does not consider us to be unemployed during that period of time that we are not under contract, so we can't get unemployment. And summers obviously are the worst. We have, months where we don't have any income.
Finding part-time work to accommodate her mutable teaching schedule is tricky, Smith says. Plus, her part-time status provides no health benefits. Smith wants to work full-time at the college.
If I do this adjunct thing for, 2 to 3 years and show how good I am, that I can be then moved up into full-time status. That is not the case. Full-time openings come up rarely.
2 generations ago, permanent full-time professors predominated on college campuses. Today, according to the Coalition on the Academic Workforce, of 1.8 million teaching at both two- and four-year colleges, 1.3 million, or more than three-quarters, are contingent, comprised of non-tenured full-time professors and teachers, as well as part-time adjunct instructors. Northwest Arkansas Community College reflects that trend. Spokesperson Stephen Hines.
Inwick has about 300 adjunct instructors and 150 full-time instructors.
Hines says there's a clear business case for hiring adjunct faculty.
One of our reasons for employing adjunct faculty members is that it allows us to have people from business and industry working directly with the students. This provides a chance for students to hear from people who are already working in their chosen field. Another reason is that it allows us to keep tuition lower while still providing a quality education. With funding from the state of Arkansas being flat, NWAC is looking for efficiencies while maintaining high-quality instruction for our students, and this is one of the ways that we are able to do that.
Scott Clifthorn refers to the steep rise in contingent faculty hires as casualization, the reallocation of full-time employees to casual or part-time positions. He's spokesperson for the advocacy and legal rights group, the American Association of University Professors, with chapters in 41 states, including two in Arkansas. Scott Clifthorn points to two trends.
In general, state funding for higher education has gone way, way down.
Forcing colleges to assemble robust development teams, for example, to raise more money, hiring less faculty.
I think most people would be shocked to learn that the national average that universities are spending on directly on instruction barely hits 30%.
In the UA system, depending upon the campus, a top administrator can earn well over $200,000, full professors half that, and instructors half that. Adjuncts earn half of what instructors earn. University of Arkansas in Fayetteville counts 1,260 instructional faculty, 1,080 are full-time, 180 are part-time. UALR counts 470 full-time instructional faculty and more than 300 part-time. And Scott Clifthorn says many contingent employees, including adjuncts, report living check to check.
In addition to being part-time, temporary, seasonal jobs, there's at most institutions, there's no ladder for progress.
Not the proverbial glass ceiling, but an ivory ceiling made opaque by what some say is a draconian tenure system. Myra Besosa is a full-time contingent faculty at California State University, San Marcos. She also serves on AAUP's National Council as a member at large. She says tenure, historically, has been conveyed only to an academic elite.
Tenure is really a way to provide economic stability, to attract people to the profession, and to guarantee academic freedom, because without permanent employment, you know, you do not really have academic freedom if you can be fired because of speech, for example.
Tenure reform is starting to take root mainly on unionized campuses, fighting against what is often characterized as the Walmartization of the American university system. Contingent faculty at the University of Illinois Chicago struck in mid-February, citing poverty wages, while the school's financial assets, according to a 2013 audit, increased by more than $300 million. But Myra Besosa says change is occurring, for example, among organized University of California lecturers.
They become eligible for permanent employment after 6 years in a department, 6 consecutive years, and they can be part or full-time. In the Cal State University, we're not there yet. I hope that we get there. But what we have are 3-year appointments that are renewable, okay? And they can be part or full-time. There's also the model of the Vancouver Community Colleges, where part-time faculty teaching half or above become regularized after a certain period of time. They become permanent.
Unions, however, have little influence in the South, and Besosa says contingent faculty can petition their peer senates to advocate for better wages and benefits. UA Fayetteville's Faculty Senate, according to an inside source, has just started discussions about contingency issues and plans to monitor hiring ratios. Rhoda Brazzo is Vice Provost for Faculty Development and Enhancement in the Division of Academic Affairs at the University of Arkansas Fayetteville.
One of the things that we're doing at the university that I am very proud of is we have included our adjunct faculty within the Teaching and Faculty Support Center. We are asking that entity to make sure that they pay attention to that. And most of the departments on campus extend voting privileges to all faculty, clinical and adjunct. And that, I think, is a sign that we are trying to be sensitive to what we would call as two distinctions or two classes of faculty. We are trying very hard to avoid that.
DeBrezzo says her administration is well aware that nationwide as much as 70% of faculty are employed off tenure track.
We're committed to not doing that here. We would much rather add tenure track faculty lines, no doubt about it.
Still, according to the numbers, UA research faculty hires have decreased by nearly 60% over the past decade, while administrative staff have increased by nearly a third. But DeBrezzo says that data doesn't tease out administrators like herself who continue to teach and the need for critical support staff to both tenured and contingent faculty. Plus,
there are no instructional faculty that are either tenure or tenure track that aren't responsible for research. So we may not call them research faculty, but they are still responsible for research.
And compared to the rest of the UA system, contingent faculty are paid more on the Fayetteville campus, according to 2012 data crunched by the Chronicle of Higher Education Adjunct Project. And Vice Provost for Faculty Development and Enhancement, Rhoda Brazzo, says durable contracts are being struck.
I don't think there is anyone on our campus that doesn't believe that as we move forward, we try and move to the top 50, as we work on retention and graduation rates, none of those initiatives are attainable without the faculty.
An AAUP Committee on Contingency report points to the collapsing faculty infrastructure as a failure of a social contract in higher education. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Jacqueline Froelich.
Later today on This American Life.
Piney is sort of this mysterious figure in our life.
I know that Piney has a lot of physical ailments.
I've heard he has a team of doctors.
I mean, my first impression was just like Piney is misunderstood.
Piney is my dog, and those are the people who I work with who do not seem to understand him. Animal sacrifices, later today.
This American Life, this morning at 10 on KUAF.
According to a new report from Arkansas Children's Hospital, Arkansas has made progress in vaccinating children. That report, titled Natural Wonders, The State of Children's Health in Arkansas, says the state has increased from 57% compliance in 2007 to 72% compliance in 2011. Scott Gordon, ACH Executive Vice President, says this is an example of where they've been able to move the needle by informing parents in a timely manner of the importance of immunizations.
And also to debunk some of the myths that have sprung up around immunization so that people can understand how safe they really are. We're really pleased with that because it does mean that kids are protected against diseases that they have no reason to contract if they are immunized. We are concerned, however, that there is some increasing use of philosophic exemptions by families which don't have a medical basis, but allow in Arkansas for families to exempt the children out from immunization. So we're going to be working to continue to educate and inform people so they can make informed choices.
According to the report, ACH has led the Natural Wonders Partnership Council since its inception in 2007. More than two dozen leaders from various fields meet monthly to share information and prioritize steps that will improve children's health and well-being. This is the fourth edition of the Natural Wonders Report, which Gordon says came from a question that was asked during a 2006 Board of Directors retreat.
One of the board members asked the question, since we do such a good job for the kids who have injury and illness and need to be in the hospital, what are we doing for the kids in Dumas? And Dumas was sort of a placeholder for all the small towns out and about around the state. So the basic question was, what are we doing to help all of the children in the state, not just the ones that are brought to us.
Gordon says they began collecting data by conducting a random survey of 1,000 families spread evenly over the state's four congressional districts, as well as by organizing focus groups and key informant groups. Gordon says they revisited that same methodology in 2012 and 2013, and they replicated it with all new people in order to gather additional information. Because they used the same method for gathering data, Gordon says they have continuity from their first data set until 2013, which means they have the beginnings of some trending information. The report looks at a variety of areas such as access to care, oral health, and unintentional injuries. The report looks at where the state has made improvements in one category and points to areas where continued intervention is needed. In the category of unintentional injury, for example, the report notes that while Arkansas infants die at almost double the national rate from sudden infant death syndrome, the state's rate of unintentional child death has dropped by 40% in the last decade. Gordon says while the state has made improvements, that number is still high compared to the rest of the country because other states are also making improvements. A comprehensive education program to help people understand there are certain things they can do to help promote the health of children in the first year of life has been one of the strategies used to address this issue.
We've done a lot of work around the idea of sleeping children on their back and not on their stomachs. We've worked to make sure that cribs are safe and don't have ways for children to get their heads caught between the slats in the cribs, or not to get covered up with blankets and smother. And we've also promoted the idea that it's not safe to put an infant in bed with adults. These things alone make a huge difference in terms of reducing the number of sudden infant death syndrome children.
Gordon says the report highlights a number of areas where they are proud of their accomplishments, such as oral health. He says Arkansas is one of only a few states that doesn't have a dental school. He says the state faces a challenge in terms of attracting enough dentists and making sure there are plenty of dentists that are willing to see children. While working to improve oral health, Gordon says they have been promoting the idea of pediatric dentistry in areas of the state that haven't had that in the past. He also says the state, through the Medicaid system, has improved the reimbursement for dentists treating kids.
We're most proud, though, of our dental sealant program that the hospital has conducted for the last 5 years. We've been able to take kids ages 6 to 9 and put sealants on their permanent teeth when they come in, and as a result, protect those teeth so they don't get cavities. When we started in 5 years ago, Arkansas had 15% of the children in the state between ages 6 and 9 that had their teeth sealed. Today, that number is 27%. And the national Healthy People 2020 goal for 2020 for the nation for this age range is only 28%. So we're really moving that needle rapidly and in a very positive direction.
ACH Executive Vice President Scott Gordon says he is also proud of the work the Injury Prevention Center, members in the Natural Wonders Coalition, and others have done to create a trauma system in the state, as well as implement primary seatbelt laws.
On an average, it takes 5 minutes and 50 seconds for a child who is identified to the trauma system to be referred to and accepted by a trauma center for care, and putting that trauma physician in touch with whoever the caregiver is at the moment. So we make that connection within 5 minutes and 50 seconds on the average now today, which for a rural state like Arkansas is phenomenal. The other thing is we've seen a major drop in the number of teen and child deaths in automobiles after we implemented the primary seatbelt law and implemented the graduated driver's license. And so we're excited because this means between 30 and 40 children each year are not killed. So those are funerals we don't have to have. These are kids whose lives are able to continue and grow, and it's just an exciting thing for our state.
When addressing issues like child health care, Gordon says one of the most important things is for the public to be informed.
The way that we can inform is both through the publishing of this report in both a hard copy and also in the electronic form at the Arkansas Children's Hospital website, so people can have ready access to accurate information and also learn about programs that are existent in the state that are addressing some of the issues that are facing children and families. It also gives communities a chance to look at what they might do in addressing the needs that they identify within their local community, so that we have a situation in which the state at all levels is mobilizing energy and resources to improve the health status of children.
You can read the full 2014 Natural Wonders Report by visiting archildrens.org/news and clicking on the Publications and Newsletters tab.
Earlier this week, papers documenting 30 years of the political career of Arkansas politician Dale Bumpers were open to researchers. Ozarks at Large's Kyle Kellums attended the ceremony, which was held inside Mullins Library on the University of Arkansas campus. Here's his report.
Dale Bumpers' stamp on politics in the second half of the 20th century is a bold one. He guided Charleston, Arkansas, to be the first school district in the South to integrate while he was city attorney there. Later, he served as Arkansas's governor and was elected to 4 terms in the U.S. Senate. Consider the names around his career. He defeated Orville Faubus in the 1970 gubernatorial primary and Winthrop Rockefeller that year in the general election. He was succeeded in the governor's mansion by first David Pryor, then Bill Clinton. And he defeated J. William Fulbright in the Democratic primary for the Senate in 1974. The collected papers of his career were formally opened at the University of Arkansas Library, finishing a 3-year process that resulted in the cataloging of more than 1,000 boxes of papers. University of Arkansas Provost Sharon Gabbard says it's fitting the papers are at Senator Bumpers' alma mater, in part because of his commitment to higher education.
Dale Bumpers understood the relationship and the correlation between research and scientific advancement. If this country had the highest quality of life in the world, it was because it also had the highest quality of research. He understood how important government research dollars were in curing childhood illnesses such as polio, hepatitis, measles, and mumps. Senator Bumpers' interests were also closely rooted in the land, how we care for it, what we grow on it, and what we provide for prosperity.
The provost estimates Senator Bumpers was responsible for more than $80 million in funds directly benefiting the university and the state of Arkansas. Senator Bumpers couldn't attend yesterday's formal opening of his papers, but his longtime political colleague and friend David Pryor was there and remembered a speech delivered by Bumpers in the Senate just after Senator Bumpers had retired. It was the closing speech of the Clinton impeachment trial.
Dale was called back into service after he had just left the Senate. He had only been out of the Senate for about 3 weeks or 2 weeks when his colleagues called him back to make the case, the final argument, in the Bill Clinton impeachment trial in the Senate. Barbara and I were traveling, but we got back home just in time in Little Rock to turn on CNN, turn on C-SPAN, I guess it was, and watch Dale Bumpers give that wonderful oration. And I can still quote from memory some parts of it. I will not do it now. I hope you will avail yourself of the opportunity to go to the archives and let Tim Nutt play you a rendition of Dale Bumpers' speech in the impeachment trial. One thing I do remember, though, that immediately upon the completion of that speech from Little Rock, I kept trying to call Dale Bumpers home in Bethesda to tell him what a magnificent job he had done. Finally, after the lines were busy all of this time, I finally reached Dale. He picked up the phone about 10 o'clock at night, about 9 o'clock that our central time in Little Rock. And I said, Dale, this is David. I just wanted you to know that this was perhaps the finest speech ever given on the floor of the United States Senate. He responded typical Bumpers fashion, I'm inclined to agree with you. So that was his response to my accolade that I was trying to send his way.
The papers include notes, letters, legislative drafts, and correspondence. Tim Nutt, the head of special collections for the University of Arkansas Libraries, says every word, photograph, and item was inspected, cataloged, and annotated. He says there is history in each volume, from the end of the Cold War to the effort bumpers led to save the Manassas battlefield from development.
Also in the collection, you can find materials on Star Wars. No, not the movie, but the Strategic Defense Initiative proposed by President Reagan in 1983. Throughout his tenure on Capitol Hill, Senator Bumpers logged hundreds of hours in service on committees, and his time there is represented well in this collection. There's even some material on one of the senator's first legislative victories, Right Turn on Red.
A collection such as the Bumpers papers also includes three-dimensional objects, what archivists term ephemera. This collection includes shovels from groundbreakings, plaques, and other commemorative items. There is also a pair of red and white shoes, a pair that would only be worn by the bravest of Razorback fans. Those shoes are explained in another piece of the collection.
While organizing this collection, we came across a letter from President Bill Clinton to Senator Bumpers. In 1997, Clinton wrote, "I can well recall cooling my heels in your office, waiting hours on end to heed the wise senior senator's always honest and often blunt counsel. I'm still upset about your not selling me those wonderful red and white patent leather Razorback shoes I'd try on in your reception area."
David Pryor pointed out that a discussion of the career of Dale Bumpers is incomplete without also talking about Betty Bumpers, the senator's wife and the founder of the organization Peace Links and a strong advocate for health issues.
Public health, vaccinations for every child in Arkansas, and ultimately around her kitchen table in Bethesda, Maryland, the formation during the bleakest times of the Cold War. The war, a worldwide organization of women dedicated to talking to one another, listening to one another, and reasoning as women and mothers rather than shooting at one another. This was Peace Links, and it was Betty Bumpers' concept of bringing peace to a very troubled time in our world. It was highly successful. This was Betty Bumpers' partial legacy.
Although Senator Bumpers was unable to attend the Wednesday afternoon event, he did write a letter that was shared by Archie Schaefer, a former staff member for Bumpers during his time as governor and senator.
The bottom line is this collection is so much more than papers. It is a study of what I worked on, and even more so of the times in which I served. You won't find much on email, because email didn't exist until my final few years, and Twitter was only what birds did. Although times have changed rapidly since I left the Senate, my years there were some of the most dramatic in our country's history. The Vietnam War ended my first year. Nelson Rockefeller was the newly minted vice president after Spiro Agnew's resignation, who swore me into office. 5 months prior to my swearing in, Gerald Ford had succeeded to the presidency after Richard Nixon's departure. Although I did not realize it at the time, I was living a major sea change in our country's history. My collection contains my vote on the Panama Canal. It was very controversial and helped shape, rightly or wrongly, the outcome of the 1980 elections. I could reminisce further, and if I were with you in person, I'm sure I would. I will close by stating my belief that collections such as these are important because they are windows to the past and help us better understand how we got to the present and what is possible in the future.
The formal opening means researchers, scholars, and reporters can now have access to those papers. And the collection joins others in the U of A special collections, such as the papers of Joe T. Robinson, David Pryor, and the first woman to ever serve in the U.S. Senate, Hattie Caraway.
Ozarks at Large's Kyle Kellums filed that report for a daily edition of Ozarks earlier this week.
When you connect the dots too early, you can easily miss the real story, the whole story. Connections and nuance go missing. At Morning Edition, we focus on collecting the dots before we try to connect them. Only then do we consider what it all means together. Listen each weekday. It's Morning Edition from NPR News.
Morning Edition, each weekday morning from 5 to 9 on your public radio station, KUAF 91.3 FM. This is Weekend Ozarks at Large. Wind chimes clink high among the branches of a Norfolk pine as traffic moves below on Lafayette and Fayetteville. I stand about 12 feet off of the ground in a treehouse built by local craftsmen with natural state treehouses. Josh Hart is the owner and main guy when it comes to building these quality and sustainable play structures. Now entering its fourth year, Hart says the spark of the business came when he and his wife wanted to build a plaything for their two young boys.
We started looking around and realized there's just, when it comes to play structures, there's nothing available that's, you know, everything's either very expensive or very low quality or more often both. And so, you know, we kind of said to ourselves, gosh, you know, somebody needs to start making, you know, sustainably built, really fun play structures for kids. That kind of planted the seed. And then a few months later, you know, it really kind of clicked for us that we've got all these carpentry skills, you know, are connected to some wonderful local carpenters. We should do that. And so that's kind of the start of the business.
He stands next to one of his completed tree houses, not far from the busy street. Though it is hidden among the pine's branches and is difficult to detect unless you're really looking for it. It's been completed since October, and I drive down this street almost every day and have never noticed it. They believe this tree to be a Norfolk pine, but it has many unusual characteristics, and it's thought to have been an experiment of the horticulture department at the University of Arkansas, as a former president of the school once resided in this home. At its base, the tree has a wide and thick trunk, but about 2 feet off of the ground, the trunk separates into six trunks, growing into different directions. Hart says the intent was to be up above the street and hidden.
And so we tucked it right up in among these six trunks. And you can see we've just got a really nice, simple, kind of old-style treehouse ladder leading up through a trap door in the floor. Some hand-carved stairs that, you know, just kind of blend into the trunk. And so this one especially, we really let the tree dictate the design.
He approaches each project differently depending on the tree, the location, and the customer. Hart says he will spend a lot of time just walking around a tree, looking at it, taking it in. And more often than not, the customer has some ideas when coming into a project.
This family actually had crayon drawings from the youngster and all kinds of good ideas. But then I'll take those ideas and work on a design, and we'll just kind of go back and forth until we get the perfect fit.
On this particular task, the platform was built with 2 feet on the ground, though two beams were attached to limbs first, and then the platform was fixed to them. Hart builds treehouses for customers of any age, some as young as 1 and 2, some teenagers, others completely grown. For the younger ones, the design is something that can be used immediately, but something that cannot be outgrown. This particular customer is 5. Federal guidelines for playground safety are followed, though he says he overbuilds everything. Hart sets a threshold of 8 feet for the height of his treehouses, because he says that's where it starts to get really fun.
It feels high, and it feels like it's a totally different world, especially for kids. And so this one, actually, we were looking at the lowest limbs are starting at about 12 feet. And so we looked at the canopy of the tree, we looked at those first limbs, and you'll see when we go up there, but it's the perfect height for this tree to feel like you're inside the tree, like you're right up there in the branches, sky above you, foliage all around you. And then, you know, being right here off of downtown Fayetteville, being right there having a perch to kind of get up away from the busyness of the world and have your own space.
Climbing up into that space is relatively easy. A small platform has been installed in the crotch of the tree to ensure stable footing, as hands grab onto wooden dowels that make up the rungs of the ladder. Small enough for little hands to hold onto, yet strong enough for the heaviest of feet. A pulley system hangs over the edge to pull up any necessary supplies so that the climb can be completed with two hands. Up through a small hole in the bottom of the platform and you're there. A trap door falls over the hole. Working around what the tree provided, Hart and his small team did not harm any living branches in the building of this house. In fact, there are many holes in the floor and the wall to allow limbs to grow through. Those in the floor have rope enclosing them.
That's just a nice little touch. It helps it feel more like an enclosed room, and fills in the gaps. But yeah, we use this. It's a wonderful natural fiber synthetic rope, same thing that we use for climbing.
Hart uses primarily Arkansas-grown cypress wood for his crafts. He says cypress is a magical material. It has the great properties of redwood or cedar, but can be found locally. The sawmill he procures wood from uses sustainable practices just a few hours east of Fayetteville. Cypress is also resistant to insects for those sticky summer nights spent high above. It is also flexible, which is necessary for building a treehouse to allow for tree growth and movement with the wind. The late winter winds were blowing something fierce, and a swaying could be felt as I stood. Hart says that the best activity for enjoying a treehouse is to just go off into your own world.
Probably the one thing that every structure that we build has in common is some kind of private space, where whether it's a kid or an adult, you can go get away from the world, be by yourself, clubhouse, fort, whatever you want to call it. It's just magic for all ages. This particular structure has just a rustic old style plank wood swing, climbing rope. Climbing activities are fabulous, build strength and just great for kids getting outside and exercising and having fun. And anything that you can imagine, just depending on what the customer is looking for.
I spy a wonderful place to curl up with a good book. Hart works on projects all over the region, from Searcy and into Missouri, and has even taken phone calls from as far away as Las Vegas from people with an interest. Small or large, off-ground or on, can be done. Customers began to take notice of Hart's eye for detail and superior workmanship, and began to ask for his help on other projects just a few months ago. A side business evolved from those requests, and he now manages the Craftsman Cooperative Natural State Carpentry, with members who are local cabinet makers, furniture makers, and makers of custom instruments.
So really anything to do with wood, we formed this cooperative so that when folks come to us and say, we want really high quality work, done with sustainable practices, that we kind of have all those connections to, if it's not something I personally know how to do, I'm connected with some craftsmen that have those skills.
Hart himself is taking part in a project not far from this treehouse on Lafayette. A deck is being built on Hill Street off of the glassed-in porch of a house with a foundation that dates to pre-Civil War. To learn more about Josh Hart's projects, visit naturalstatetreehouses.com. This is Ozarks at Large.
There's a house at the top of a tree. There's a house at the top of a tree. In the house, there's a room. In the room, there's a chair. And sitting in the chair is you.
This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Christina Thomas.
And I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
It is time for our Sunday morning montage.
It is. It's also time for March Madness, which kind of influenced the montage this week. It's also known as the Big Dance. And it started earlier this week. And do you fill out a bracket?
I don't know.
You don't?
No, I have no idea what's going on. I mean, I know that
madness. There's lots of madness.
Lots of madness. Yes, yes. I like basketball.
Sure,
but
it's always it's fun for me. There's a group of friends who we all just sort of fill one out. Some of us know what we're doing. Some of us have no idea. It's all just a lot of fun, and it's all for fun. And it makes you want to watch the games, It makes you a little more competitive and care a little bit more about what's happening, which is fun. And what's so interesting about college basketball is people are fairly evenly matched mm-hmm. in the tournament. So at any given point, someone could be upset, winning by a point or something like that. Someone who was ranked 12th beating a number 5 seed. That happened with Harvard winning. They were number 12 seed and they beat a number 5 seed. So it's been an interesting week, and I look forward to more of the tournament as the weeks go on.
Well, there you go. You'll have to fill me in.
I will. I'll be happy to.
Do we have any idea why it's called the Big Dance?
I don't know exactly. It's just what I've heard it called. So that inspired our colleague Kyle Kellums to put together this montage about dance.
Would you like to learn to tango, Donna?
Right now?
I'm offering you my services, free of charge. What do you say?
I think I'd be a little afraid.
Of what?
Afraid of making a mistake.
No mistakes in the tango, Donna. Not like life. Simple. That's what makes the tango so great. If you make a mistake, get all tangled up. Just tango on.
I could have danced all night. I could have danced all night and still have begged for more.
I watch a show every day on a Billings, Montana station, and I love Gene the Dancing Machine. I just wish you'd give him another chance. So, all right, let's give him another chance. Lay it on now. Here comes Gene the Dancing Machine.
Want to dance?
No.
I do believe Marcellus, my husband, your boss, told you to take me out and do whatever I wanted. And now I want to dance. I want to win. I want that trophy.
From the oldest of times, people danced for a number of reasons. They danced in prayer, or so that their crops would be plentiful, or so their hunt would be good. And they danced to stay physically fit and show their community spirit. And they danced to celebrate.
Just one last question. Can I ask you, Billy, what does it feel like when you're dancing?
Dunno. Sort of feels good. It's sort of stiff in that. But once I get going, then I like forget everything.
Dancing and singing.
How you did on this morning's montage, go to OzarksAtLarge.com.
Good morning. It is Sunday, March 23rd, 2014. This is Weekend Ozarks at Large. I'm Christina Thomas.
I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
Joining us now is Becca Martin Brown. She is features editor with Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
Well, here we are.
Here we are.
We're not on spring break.
No.
Oh, okay. Well, it's okay because we have some suggestions. The Friday before spring break in What's Up, we always talk about road trips. And so we have some suggestions that you can either take on this week if you have a chance, or you can save them and perhaps go this summer. We looked at regional museums in five cities, and the first one is Kansas City.
Of course. You love the Nelson Atkins.
I do. Well, I grew up. That was my city growing up. And the Nelson Atkins Museum is what they call encyclopedic, which means they have everything. It's not like a Museum of American Art or a Museum of Native American History. And if you're kids, you can see all sorts of cool things. The director says it's like getting into a time machine. You can go any place in history. So you can go and see stuff from Egypt when the pharaohs ruled. Or you can go and see a knight seated on a horse in full armor. Or you can go and see the Americas when buffalo roamed the plains. One of my favorite places is from the Middle Ages, and it's part of a church, and mm-hmm. it's gorgeous.
It's a great room.
They have 33,000 objects. You'll find some you like. Right now, out on the grounds, they're putting up a glass labyrinth.
What?
And it's not done yet.
When's it going to be done?
May.
Okay, so I need to go in May.
But they said people are having a really good time watching it.
How cool.
Go up. And, of course, everybody loves the shuttlecocks.
Those are awesome.
But visitors are warned not to climb on them because they have a microphone out around in the sculpture gallery to keep people off the art.
Huh.
Apparently the kids love being told to get off the sculptures. Also, while you're in Kansas City, the Arabia Steamboat Museum, which I love. Its cargo recovered from the sinking of the steamship Arabia in 1856. Cool, cool, cool. Sort of like the Titanic, but without tragedy. The Kemper Museum of Contemporary Art. And Science City, which is in Union Station. You can dig for fossils or train to be an astronaut. It's one of the country's 25 best science centers, according to Parents Magazine.
Sounds good.
And all these things are online at nwaonline.com/whatsup.
Sounds good.
Thank you, Becca. Becca Martin Brown is Features Editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
I'm Bob Garfield. On this week's On the Media, researchers tested the government and found that even after 50 years, federal agencies still haven't figured out how to respond to Freedom of Information requests.
7 of those 15 agencies received a failing grade. Nobody got an A. They struggled. They really did.
Don't miss this week's On the Media from WNYC.
It begins later this morning at 11 on 91.3 FM.
Local band Little Chief recently came into our studio to discuss their new album, Lion's Den. On Friday, you heard them perform a song, and here's another one off that album.
This song is called Gold in the Morning.
Find out more about the band at littlechiefband.com.
Support for KUAF comes from Edible Ozark Arkansas. This quarterly magazine focuses on food, farms, and culture in the Ozarks. Proceeds benefit hunger relief efforts through Feed Fayetteville and Feed Communities. More information, including subscriptions, available at edibleozarkansas.com.
This is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Rogers, Fort Smith, Paris.
Paris, mm-hmm. Arkansas.
Paris, Arkansas.
All right, cool. Have you ever been there?
I have been. Paris, Arkansas, not Paris, Paris.
Right.
Not Paris, France. Cool. But yes, to Paris, Arkansas. I've been there a couple of times. It's a quaint little town.
All right. Well, Weekend Ozarks is a production of KUAF. I'm Christina Thomas.
And I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
I will be back tomorrow, Monday, for an all-new daily edition of Ozarks at Large. Until then, thank you so much for listening.
And have a great Sunday.